the June 7th home opener against the Ticats. Plus, pregame on the west sidelines and VIP entry to Stamps House for an amazing meal before the game. You'll even hang out with Sarah and Andy. Listen for the VIP night code word at 6 a.m., 8 a.m., 3 p.m., 5 p.m., and 7 p.m. Then enter it at QRCalgary.com. Win a Stamps VIP night out from your Stampeder station, QR Calgary.
QR Calgary is 770 CHQR AM, a Chorus Entertainment radio station.
This is Global News. I'm Joshua Azizi. The Liberal caucus has voted down rules that would have strengthened the say of backbenchers in who should lead their party.
Many Liberal MPs still feel the shock and awe of former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau clinging to power for months, even as calls from within his party grew for him to step down before he finally did in January. But not enough of them felt this way to adopt new rules set out under the Reform Act that would prevent that from happening again by emboldening caucus members, allowing them to force a leadership review. Liberals were tight-lipped after their meeting. Caucus Chair James Maloney would only confirm that a majority voted against adopting the rules. Kyle Duggan, The Canadian Press, Ottawa.
Pierre Poilievre is signaling that the Liberals might have some Conservative support when it comes to resolving Canada's trade war with the United States. The Conservative leader met with his caucus Sunday, a day before the House of Commons is set to return. He says he's willing to cooperate with the Liberals when it comes to reestablishing Canada's sovereignty and economic independence.
I've already told the Prime Minister that we are happy to cooperate any way we can to bring about an end to this unnecessary dispute and restore not just our sovereignty, but also tariff-free access to the most successful international trading arrangement in the world.
Poilievre is also accusing Prime Minister Mark Carney of putting his elbows down after tough talk around counter-tariffs during the election campaign. Meanwhile, King Charles will visit Canada Monday for the first time since his coronation. He will read the speech from the throne Tuesday, becoming the first monarch since 1977 to read the document. Russia and Ukraine completed the final round of their prisoner swap hours after Moscow launched a major aerial assault.
A rare moment of cooperation between Russia and Ukraine. As the third and final prisoner exchange that began Friday ended Sunday. In all, each country exchanged 1,000 prisoners, many of them soldiers, hours earlier. Ukraine's capital and other regions came under a massive Russian drone and missile attack that killed at least 12 people and injured dozens. Ukrainian officials said the attack hit more than 30 cities and villages, describing it as the largest aerial assault since Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022. I'm Julie Walker.
Talks between Canada Post and negotiators from its union are expected to resume over the next few days. The two parties met Sunday amid warnings of mail delivery delays tied to a national ban on overtime for postal workers. A statement this afternoon from the Canadian Union of Postal Workers says negotiators had worked hard to carefully evaluate Canada Post's latest offers and prepare responses. The union learned in the early afternoon Sunday that Canada Post had left the premises in order to review the documents from the union and would take a few days to get back to them. Monday marks 1 month since a man drove a vehicle into the crowd at Vancouver's Lapu-Lapu Day Festival, killing 11 people and injuring others. In New Westminster, an actor famous for his guest role on Seinfeld as the soup Nazi lifted up his ladle to raise money for the victims. Larry Thomas served soup at the Greens and Beans Deli Sunday, where he's visited many times in the past for similar fundraisers.
This feels great. I mean, it just feels like I'm doing something good, and who doesn't want to do that?
And yes, he said his iconic line.
Do you have any buns?
No soup for you.
Thomas's first fundraiser at the deli was 20 years ago after the Indian Ocean tsunami. From the Global News Desk, I'm Joshua Azizi.
The ongoing history of new music with Alan Cross.
This episode begins shortly after 9 a.m. on the Saturday I turned 6. For reasons that will forever remain mysterious, the present from my grandmother was a Lloyd's portable transistor radio, model TR-62, made in Taiwan, built with 6 transistors. This thing was amazing. It revealed a wider world to me. See, I grew up in a small town with three TV stations, one of which was in French, and the only radio I heard was what Mom and Dad listened to in the kitchen or in the car. But now that I had my own radio, I discovered that there were many, many, many other stations out there. And in the wintertime, when the atmosphere turned into a giant reflector for distant AM signals, I started listening to stations from Minneapolis and Denver and Chicago and St. Louis and many others. At some point after that, I decided that I wanted to be part of this world of news and information and entertainment and music. And to make a long story short, here I am. Now, of course, you may be listening to this as an internet stream or as a podcast, but the original construction of this program is for traditional terrestrial over-the-air FM radio. Now, radio is everywhere. It's the clock radio, the kitchen, the stereo in the living room, the car, the office, the gym, the store. In fact, there are so many radios out there that they outnumber people in North America. There are thousands of FM stations and thousands of AM stations. But because radio is so ubiquitous, people don't give it much thought. It's always been there. It's always been free. And it's always been so easy to use. Radio has become so tightly integrated into our lives that we don't notice it perhaps as much as we should. And then there were those who maintained that radio was dead and that nobody listens anymore, which is just rubbish. I could cite you all kinds of statistics to prove that radio is still very popular, very powerful, and very profitable. For example, I can tell you that almost 90% of the population listens to radio over the course of a week. Take my word for that. It's true. But radio is in a period of transition as new technologies come into play. However, the radio industry is very aware of what's going on. And these are all the reasons why I want to talk about radio. Plus, it'll give me an excuse to play some great songs about the medium. Oh, and did I mention that radio has now officially been around for 100 years? Yes. Yes, it has. And here's its story. Okay, this 100 years is a bit of an approximation, but I will give you a fact. On May 20th, 1920, a radio station in Montreal called CFCF went on the air. CFCF apparently stood for Canada's First, Canada's Finest, and it seems to be the first properly programmed radio station in the world. Now, we will come back to that a little later because there's a bit of a fight involved with this. For generations, radio has always been there, and it's been free. You just turn it on, and there it is. Music, news, sports, weather, talk, company, just by flicking a switch. Ever wonder where it came from? Why there's AM and FM? Did you know that the radio that you're listening to right now won't work in Russia or Japan? That your AM car radio is useless in Australia? And that Norway has moved out of AM and FM entirely? Who was the first radio DJ? Why are there radio DJs in the first place? Why do all Canadian radio stations have call letters that begin with the letter C? And what of radio in the future? We're going to talk about all that, and here we go. First of all, how many times have you been told that radio was invented by Guglielmo Marconi? Well, he did not. He invented something called the wireless telegraph. He was able to send Morse code signals through the air, but not speech and not music. All he wanted to do was be able to communicate with ships at sea via Morse code. Now, there is a Canadian connection here. On December 12, 1901, Marconi went to St. John's, Newfoundland, where he successfully received a wireless transmission from a station in Portsmouth, England. The transmission was the letter S in Morse code, of course. It just went dit, dit, dit. By 1905, Marconi's wireless telegraph was being used by sailors all over the world, making Marconi a very rich guy. But not everybody can understand Morse code. I mean, can you? The first guy to actually broadcast his voice through the air was a Canadian-born engineer named Reginald Fessenden. While working in his lab near Washington, D.C. in 1900, he apparently was able to transmit and receive something intelligible. The first words ever broadcast over the air were 1, 2, 3, 4. Then came December 24th, 1906. That's when Fessenden presided over the first proper radio broadcast from Brant Rock, Massachusetts. It was basically a proof of concept thing that he hoped to use to attract financial investors. It began with him playing a bit of classical music from Handel on a phonograph. Fessenden then read something from the Bible and then played O Holy Night on his violin. Sailors, out in the Atlantic, accustomed to hearing nothing more than dots and dashes of Morse code, were a little freaked out by this. And in the space of those few minutes, Fessenden became the first DJ, the first radio performer, and the first radio announcer. Radio was born. The first people into radio were the geeks, the people who loved to experiment with new ways of transmitting and receiving broadcasts. It was a cult similar to what we saw with the early days of the internet. And the technology was really primitive, really unreliable, using things called spark or arc transmitters. They were terrible things, very temperamental, very unreliable. Fortunately, Lee DeForest was one of these early radio geeks. His big invention was the Audion, a vacuum tube that tamed radio waves in such a way that reliable radio broadcasting and receiving was made possible. It's the same device that later became the heart of amplifiers. While trying to improve upon transmitter technology, he experimented with broadcasting the results of yacht races and even oversaw a broadcast of a performance by Enrico Caruso from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City on January 3rd, 1910. This is where he performed the music of Cavalleria Rusticana and also Pagliacci. Mics were suspended above the stage, and a transmitter and antenna was set up in the wings. It worked, but nobody heard it because nobody had a radio yet. If you had an amateur setup, maybe, but there was more static than music. Then there was a guy named Charles Herold. In April 1910, about 4 months later, he used primitive amateur... Then there was a guy named Charles Herold. In April 1910, about 4 months later, he used primitive amateur radio gear to give wireless phonograph concerts in and around San Jose, California. Oh, and I should also point out that in these early days, all radio was envisioned as being two-way communication. And this is why the U.S. Navy was put in charge of radio in that country. The Navy was also in charge of radio in Canada until 1922, but then it was transferred to the Department of Marine and Fisheries for a while before the country ended up with a dedicated regulator. The fisheries people started issuing licenses to single stations, as well as to the Canadian National Railway, who eventually set up their own radio network. Back then, there were two types of users. There were fans, who were people that broadcast and received radio. Listeners was the derogatory term given to lurkers, people who would just sit and listen instead of contribute. That sound familiar? And people were very distrustful of this new technology. Electromagnetic radio waves were affecting the weather, causing droughts, one headline read. Radio waves made by bed springs vibrate so much that I couldn't sleep. I know what you mean. They make my floorboards creak so much that I'm up all night. My child started vomiting when the radio was switched on. Again, you know, with Wi-Fi and 5G, sounds familiar, right? Americans will tell you that the first radio station was KDKA in Pittsburgh. Canadians have a different story. We say it was XWA in Montreal. Now, as far as anybody can tell, XWA, and the X stood for experimental, by the way, and run by the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company of Canada, was the first licensed radio station in all of North America. And it was all totally telegraphic at first. No voice, no music, just dots and dashes. See, nothing could be done to further radio as we know it through the years of the Great War. Wireless was considered to be too much of a military advantage for anybody else to play with. So Canada banned civilian use of radio in August 1914. The U.S. did something similar. But with the end of the war in November 1918, the ban on public wireless was lifted and things began to explode. That was in the U.S. The Canadian ban was removed on May 1st, 1919. Voice transmission tests using DeForest's Audion technology began in the spring of 1919 using a 500-watt transmitter at XWA's facility at 173 William Street in Montreal. After a while, the engineers got bored with talking. They were usually asked to recite the alphabet or count to 100 over and over and over again. So they started getting audio from phonograph records that they grabbed from the nearby Leighton Brothers record store. They got on-air credit for this, making Leighton Brothers one of radio's first advertisers. Also that year, a pianist named Willie Eckstein gave a live performance on XWA as part of this testing. The first documented entertainment-based broadcasting for the general public happened on May 20th, 1920. Soprano Dorothy Hutton sang two ballads from the XWA studio in Montreal. KDKA in Pittsburgh didn't go on the air until November 2nd, 1920, 6 months later. And that's when they broadcast the results of the U.S. presidential election. Then again, a station in Detroit named 8MK did exactly the same thing on the same day. That could have been the first proper radio news program. Sports? The first play-by-play broadcast was in 1921. It was a college game between West Virginia and Pittsburgh. So, XWA and Reginald Fessenden. That's 2 points to Canada when it comes to the invention of radio. In these early days of radio, things were pretty chaotic. There were no rules or regulations, and the airwaves were a mess. Amateurs, newspapers, churches, entrepreneurs, they all had their own radio stations doing their own things. And sometimes they had to share frequencies. One station got to broadcast X number of hours per day on a certain frequency, after which they had to relinquish that frequency so that station Y could go on the air. Sometimes this frequency sharing was cooperative, and other times stations just went at it to the point where no one could receive anything. Eventually, though, governments imposed order. In April 1922, for example, the Canadian government issued 21 licenses to be used for private commercial broadcasting. By the end of the year, there were 58, and within 10 years, there were 77 such stations. In the U.S., 28 stations were up and running by 1922. By 1924, there were more than 1,400, many of which were screwing with each other. So in 1927, the Federal Radio Commission was formed and started reassigning stations to various specific frequencies and regulated the power of transmitters. Both these moves in Canada and the United States created a proper radio industry that operated in the public interest. Also, once licenses started being granted, various entrepreneurs tried to figure out how to make money from something that appeared out of thin air. Well, here's one way. Companies that made radios then set up radio stations so their customers could listen to their radios. This would be the equivalent of Microsoft creating Internet Explorer and then setting up the Microsoft network. An example would be the Marconi Model C, which was put together in the first purpose-built radio factory in Chelmsford, England. In 1921, during the first year of proper radio broadcasting, one of these things sold for $195. That's the equivalent of $2,500 today. Clearly a luxury for the privilege of receiving not much. Still, about 1,000 were sold. All these early radio stations were on the AM band. That's because AM, which stands for amplitude modulation, which describes how frequencies are propagated through the air, is the simplest form of broadcasting technologies. And AM ruled for 50 years, all the way from the 1920s through to the 1970s. Although, I probably don't have to say this, but AM is very, very analog.
You'd have to wait, but you could hear it on the AM radio.
Everclear, singing about the glories of an old-time AM radio. It was while working for RCA, the Radio Corporation of America, Edwin Howard Armstrong, one of the engineers who helped put KDKA on the air in Pittsburgh, he discovered a new static-free way of broadcasting. He called it frequency modulation, or FM for short. It took more than a decade for Armstrong to work out the science and mathematics of FM broadcasting, but by 1933 it was ready. And on June 9th, 1934, at exactly 10:23 a.m., the first FM broadcast was made from the top of the Empire State Building. It was an organ recital. FM radio had arrived. That's a 2015 song by Dar Williams called FM Radio. So although Armstrong's new method of radio broadcasting was way better in every imaginable way, money and ego and greed and TV held FM back. And in the end, this destroyed Howard Armstrong. On February 1st, 1954, broken and depressed, Howard dressed in his best suit and overcoat, put on his hat and gloves, and jumped from his 13th floor window of his apartment.
And the radio was in the- the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. Radio is the sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation.
At this moment, an untold amount of electromagnetic radiation is going through your body. Most of these frequencies are empty, which is to say they aren't carrying any kind of information. Others are filled with video, Wi-Fi, mobile phones, satellite signals, and anything else that can be zipped from place to place wirelessly. AM radio, which you'll remember is short for amplitude modulation, is also known as medium wave, which is why some radios are marked with MW as well as or in place of AM. In North America, the AM radio band starts at 520 kilohertz and goes as high as 1710 kilohertz. Stations are spaced 10 kilohertz apart. However, in other parts of the world, they're spaced 9 kilohertz from each other. This is where we need to talk about the International Telecommunication Union. This is an agency of the United Nations that deals with coordinating international broadcast regulations. It's been around since, wait for it, 1865. Dates all the way back to the days of the telegraph. The world of broadcast radio is divided into three regions. Europe is Region 1. North and South America, with the exception of some Caribbean countries, make up Region 2. And the Middle East, South Asia, China, Japan, Southeast Asia, Australia, and New Zealand are Region 3. In Regions 1 and 3, AM stations are spaced 9 kilohertz apart, starting at 531 kilohertz. So that means if you have a digital radio, you might not be able to receive AM radio in most of the world because it automatically locks in on the tens, 530, 540, 550, 560, and so on. You can't properly tune in a station at, say, 888 kilohertz. FM is different. It's in the VHF part of the spectrum, just above where we used to find Channel 6 on television. In North America, FM starts at 87.9 megahertz and goes up to 107.9. After that, we get into air traffic control frequencies. But not all FM is the same. Our dial goes 87.9, 88.1, 88.3, 88.5, and so on. In the UK and most of Europe, even numbers are used. So it's 88.0, 88.2, 88.4. In Italy, you can have a station at 88.25. And there are even weirder ways of dividing up the band in other countries. And it gets even more strange. In some parts of what used to be the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, FM runs from 65 to 74 megahertz, which means none of our radios will work. Same thing in Japan, where FM runs from 76 to 90 megahertz. Even our FM used to be different. Back in 1939, during the days Edwin Howard Armstrong was fighting with Lee DeForest and RCA, all FM stations in North America were slotted between 42 and 50 megahertz. But then in the middle 40s, several broadcasting companies urged the U.S. government to move FM into its current spot. That move came on January 15, 1945, which meant that all FM radios sold up to that point were completely useless. While we're still on the technical side of things, let's talk about call letters. These are the 3- and 4-letter call signs assigned to a licensed radio station. You can think of them as the station's license plate. Call letters are regulated by governments and international treaties. In Canada, the first letter of all radio stations must be C. The only exceptions are to be found in Newfoundland, where some older ones begin with V. And that's because they were around when Newfoundland wasn't part of Confederation and had their own call signs. There's a little bit of flexibility when it comes to the second letter. It has to be F, H, I, J, or K. So all stations in Canada must begin either CF, CH, CI, CJ, or CK. No exceptions, except in Newfoundland, of course. And all radio stations in Canada must have 4 letters in their call signs. The only exceptions are the oldest radio stations. When they were founded in the 1920s or early 30s, they had signs with 3 letters, and there are still a few of those, CKX and Brandon, for example. Over in the U.S., they have their own rules. If the station is east of the Mississippi, the first letter of the call sign has to be W. If it's west, it has to be K. Now, there are some exceptions because they were either grandfathered in when the new rules came into being, or because the Mississippi isn't really a good dividing line. Minnesota would be a very good example because that's where the Mississippi begins and just it gets weird. And this gives me an excuse to play this song. Up until 1973, the only legal radio broadcasting in the UK came from the publicly funded BBC. There was no private radio in the UK until 73. That changed on October 16th, 1973, when a station called Capital FM signed out at 95.8 FM and 557 AM. And for years, Capital FM kept things very, very safe, just mass appeal mainstream pop music. But then punk broke. The BBC wouldn't touch it, so attention turned to Capital Radio. But they wouldn't touch that music either, which greatly annoyed The Clash, who couldn't get airplay anywhere. So they wrote this song, in which they expressed their displeasure. From April 1977, this is The Clash with Capital Radio. Clash, who were so upset at one particular British radio station that they wrote a song about it. And this would be a good time to talk about the people you hear on the radio, the so-called disc jockey. Now, strictly speaking, there isn't any such thing as a radio disc jockey anymore, because virtually all the music you hear from the radio is played from some kind of hard disc playback system. Music is delivered to the radio station via secure digital downloads, and from there the songs are transferred right to a server. There are no discs, unless you count the platters inside the hard drives. But back in the day, records and CDs ruled. And this brings us to another piece of Canadian radio history. The first ever proper radio DJ was born in Canada. But before we get to him, this requires some setup. In the early days, most everything you heard come out of the speakers was live. All the music was from live bands. All the news was read live. And all the drama and comedy shows were performed live. And it had to be. It wasn't until after World War II that we got magnetic recording tape, which made pre-recording things practical and easy. Until then, making pre-recorded radio programs was complicated and the technology wasn't very good. But there was also the issue of the musicians' unions. They did not want records being played over the radio. That, they said, threatened to put them out of work. This fight carried on until the 1940s, when, in America, the musicians' union went on strike. No musician could play live on the radio during that time. And this was a mess that took several years to sort out. Some recorded music, gramophone records mostly, was used on licensed radio stations as early as 1926, but only as a last case scenario filler. Everything else had to be live. That was the rule. But in 1932, a Canadian-born announcer named Al Jarvis convinced his boss at an L.A. radio station to let him create a show that involved nothing more than him playing records and talking between songs. Then, in 1935, a New York announcer named Martin Block started something called Make Believe Ballroom. Each show was divided into segments of 15 minutes. For that time, a performer was featured on an imaginary revolving stage. Block would talk about them as if they were actually there, but they weren't. He was just playing records. So where did the phrase disc jockey come from in the first place? That's unknown, but the first time the phrase first appeared in print was July 23, 1941, in Variety, the showbiz paper. By the 1950s, thousands of people were working in the business, all calling themselves disc jockeys. Radio became very, very, very big during the Depression. Once you acquired radio, it was cheap entertainment. National networks were established with all manner of news and entertainment. The biggest showbiz stars in the world were radio performers, singers, band leaders, comedians. There were quiz shows, soap opera performers. When World War II happened, radio was the way people heard what was happening. 9 out of 10 people had a radio. Newspapers weren't really happy about this, especially when some stations started reading stories from the paper. I mean, why buy a paper when you can just turn on the radio and hear the news for free? For a while, papers banned stations from reading their stories on the air until after the papers hit the streets. This tension led to the creation of news organizations like the Associated Press and radio stations setting up their own in-house newsrooms. Those started popping up in the 1930s. The rock and roll DJ was born in the 1950s in Nashville, Memphis, and Cleveland. All these cities had stations with powerful AM transmitters with signals that could reach dozens of states all the way up into Canada. They also devoted portions of their broadcast day to playing what was called race records. These were rhythm and blues records by black artists, exciting new music that was devoured by white kids looking for something forbidden, or at the very least, something that their parents found awful. There was Dewey Phillips at WHBQ and WDIA in Memphis. Gene Nobles was at WLAC in Nashville. And of course, there was Alan Freed, first from WJW in Cleveland and then WINS in New York. These guys, and they were almost exclusively guys, were a new breed of entertainer and cultural curator. They told the kids what was good, what was hot, how to talk, how to dress, what records to buy, what shows to go see. They were the spreaders of this new thing called rock and roll. The Ramones with Do You Remember Rock and Roll Radio? Welcome again, I'm Alan Cross, and this is part two of our look back at 100 years of this thing that we call radio. Not only are we looking at the history of the medium, but I'm also trying to explain why things work in radio the way they do. Let's begin this chapter with the origins of the phrase top 40. Now that's a bit of a strange number. Why 40 and not some other number? We need to go back to an empty bar in Omaha, Nebraska. We're a bit foggy on the air. It might be 1951, could be 1955. It all depends on which version of the story you want to believe. Todd Storrs and Bill Stewart had been hired to fix a radio station called KOWH. This station was dead last in Omaha, and Storrs and Stewart had to find some way of turning things around. As they sat in this bar, the story goes, they noticed that people kept going over to the jukebox and playing the same several songs over and over and over again all night. Now that gave them an idea. Why not play records on the radio like they were being played on that jukebox? The same big songs over and over and over again. Give the people what they want. Repetition. This is such an important lesson. People always ask, why do radio stations play the same songs over and over again? The answer is because decades of doing this has proven time and time again that this is what you need to do in order to get any kind of ratings. Commercial radio is supported by advertising. Running commercials is the only way to make money. The more people you have listening to your station, the more you can charge for running commercials. And playing the hits on repeat is how you get more people to listen. Now look, if this did not work, do you think everybody would be doing it? Radio station owners will play almost anything if it attracts the ears of the public. And decades of experience have proven that repetition of songs works. Okay, back to Storrs and Stewart. Legend has it that they then picked 40 songs for the playlist at this radio station, KOWH, and played them over and over and over again. When they started, KOWH had a 4% share of the market. 6 months later, it had a 45% share. And it was only a matter of time before this formula was copied all over the world. So that's the legend of Top 40. Okay, here's the real story. Sometime in the early 1950s, Storrs ran a New Orleans radio station. A competing radio station was killing him with a program called the Top 20 at 1280, 1280 being the dial position of the station. Thinking that 40 was twice as good as 20, Storrs launched a program called the Top 40 at 1450, 1450 being the frequency of that station. And he started it an hour earlier. When Storrs moved to Omaha several years later, he just expanded that top 40 concept to 24 hours a day. In any event, you can thank or blame Todd Storrs for top 40 radio, the form of music radio that dominates even today. The Talking Heads from their 1986 album True Stories, that's Radiohead. And, that is where the band got their name. In the 1950s, radio was the main vehicle for the spread of this new thing called rock and roll. This is worth exploring. There were predictions in the late 1940s that television was going to kill radio. And if you know how radio was made and used back then, you can see why. Radio just wasn't for music and news. There were soap operas and dramas. There were comedies and live concerts. The radio stars of the day rivaled those of motion pictures when it came to fame. But with the arrival of television, a lot of radio stars made the jump to the new medium. The period from 1948 to 1952 was for television, what the 1920s were for radio. The thinking was, well, I just listen to your entertainment when you could watch it. Radio's dead. It's done. Well, no. It evolved from carrying all kinds of entertainment to largely a vehicle for music. And the thing that allowed this thing to happen was a new trend called rock and roll. A couple of things allowed rock and roll to spread as fast as it did. The first was radio in the car. The world became more mobile in the years following World War II, and people wanted to take their radios with them. The first car radio was appeared in 1930, the Motorola 5T71. It was a huge and delicate thing with vacuum tubes, and they were expensive. A car might sell for $600 back then. The radio option might put another $120 on top of that. Now, there were politicians who hated this whole concept. It was the equivalent of today's campaigns of getting people to stop texting and Facebooking while driving. The leader of the anti-radio distracted driving campaign was George A. Parker, the registrar of motor vehicles in the state of Massachusetts. He wanted the state to ban the installation and use of radios in cars. Listening to radio while driving causes crashes, he said, and he came very close to having his way. But the good citizens of Massachusetts rose up as one and shouted him down. Parker went on to target drunk drivers instead, which was a much better thing. The other thing was the iPod, the iPhone of its day, the transistor radio. Up until 1954, radios were big, clunky pieces of furniture that took up space in the living room. Listening to the radio was a communal experience, something that the whole family did at the same time. People gathered around the big radio, much like they'd soon gather around the big TV. This made it very difficult for the young people of the mid-50s who were looking to be different from their parents. And one of the things that allowed them to be different was a new radio, the transistor radio. Transistor radios were tiny portable things that could be taken anywhere. They also came with little earpieces, which meant you could listen to them privately. It was to the young people of the 1950s what smartphones are to young people today. It was a liberating device. The transistor radio and rock and roll arrived at exactly the same time. This new social and economic construct called a teenager could then take his or her music with them everywhere, out of sight and out of earshot of mom and dad. And when you consider the impact of rock music on society, the transistor radio became one of the most important technological innovations of the 20th century. By serving up rock and roll anywhere, anytime, it became a delivery mechanism for a cultural revolution, a social revolution, an economic revolution, a political revolution, a technological revolution, and a sexual revolution. That's Jonathan Richman, the Modern Lover, singing about driving at night with the radio blasting. That song is from 1972, by the way. AM radio was the thing. From the invention of radio until the late 1970s. And this is what it was like at its peak.
KHJ Los Angeles.
601 in Surf City, Los Angeles, with Charlie Tuna.
Charlie Tuna, 93 KHJ.
I stand on my records. Breaks and tune. 603 from KHJ. Sounds like a resuscitator unit gone wild. The zombies, time.
Some AM stations had big, big signals that could be heard thousands of miles away, especially at night, when the atmosphere turned into a big mirror, reflecting AM broadcasts back from space down to Earth. There was also something called clear channel stations, meaning that their good dial positions and powerful transmitters were grandfathered into any new regulations. A 50,000-watt clear channel radio station could be heard across three dozen states and a bunch of provinces. No other stations were allowed to use that frequency, so their signals were interference-free. But then there were the stations in Mexico. While Canadian and American AM stations were capped at 50,000 watts, some stations in Mexico ran at 100,000, 250,000, or even 500,000 watts. Those stations could be heard everywhere, even Europe and the Soviet Union, if the atmospheric conditions were right. Birds and other animals coming too close to the transmitters would be literally cooked to death because of the amount of radio frequency radiation. The stations right on the other side of the U.S.-Mexican border were called border blasters, and the most famous of all of them was XERF-AM in Ciudad Acuña, which is right across the border from Del Rio, Texas. The station boasted that if you got into a car in New York, you could drive all the way to L.A. without losing the signal. XERF-AM was the home of a guy named Robert Smith, better known as Wolfman Jack. And if you've ever seen the movie American Graffiti, you'll know the guy. There was also XERB, which ran at 500,000 watts, half a million watts, out of Rosarito Beach near Tijuana, and just 10 minutes from the border crossing with San Diego. They were really sneaky. First, the station branded itself as being the mighty 1090 in Hollywood. Second, they said that they only ran at 50,000 watts, which was the legal limit for a U.S. AM station. Wolfman Jack worked there, too, recording his shows in Los Angeles and then shipping them south. Here's a sample from 1966.
XERB.
This is 50,000 watt clear channel XERB, Radio North America, Central Studios, Los Angeles, 1090 on your dial.
Hey, baby, welcome on in here to the Wolfman Jack Show for a Tuesday night.
He rocks in the treetop all the day long, popping and a popping and a singing song. All the little birds on.
Border blaster radio stations were a huge, huge deal in the 1960s. And now you know the inspiration behind this song from Wall of Voodoo. Stan Ridgway and his band Wall of Voodoo singing about Mexican radio. Border blasting Mexican AM radio from 1983. There was no question that FM was superior to AM. Much better sound, almost no static from lightning or power lines, automobile ignition systems, streetcar lines, or anything else like that. But because AM was so big and so profitable and so powerful, no one wanted to invest in anything that might spoil the party. In many cities, up to 50% of the population listened to that one big AM radio station. 50%! And even if you were in second or third place in the ratings, you were still making buckets of money, so why rock that boat? And no one wanted to be the one to tell the public that to get FM, you needed to buy a special new radio. But there were a few experimental FM stations in the U.S. that started broadcasting in the 30s. Canada really didn't get on board until the 1960s, at least as far as commercial radio goes. The CBC started working with FM in the 50s, and the first private commercial FM station in Canada appears to be CKVL in Montreal. The problem is that nobody seems to remember when it first signed on. Could have been as early as 1947 or as late as 1957. That's how much people took notice of FM in those days. CKVL exists today as CQA FM. Oh, by the way, CKVL does exist today. It's now called CQA FM. Western Europe got into FM radio after World War II because the AM band was way too crowded, too much interference. German broadcasters were stripped of all their AM frequencies, save for two. So the only option they had was to make the move to FM. Hence, German manufacturers like Blaupunkt being the first to make FM radios in large numbers. Meanwhile, in England, the BBC started FM broadcasting in 1955. Unlicensed pirate broadcasters were the first to use FM in Italy and Greece. And although Australia got into FM broadcasting as early as 1947, all experimental stations, and that's all they were, as experimental stations, were abandoned in 1961. FM stayed dormant in Australia until 1975. New Zealand didn't get private FM stations until 1983. The first FM radio for cars appeared in 1952, thanks to Blaupunkt, yes, that German company. The following year, Becker introduced what we think was the first AM-FM radio. Those units used old-fashioned vacuum tubes, which would burn out or come loose. The first all-transistor radio for the car appeared in 1963, and again, that came from Becker. And in 1969, Becker introduced the first ever FM stereo radio for the car. Station owners who required FM signals needed to put something on them, so for years, FM stations were simply used as simulcasts of their AM stations. Same AM programming, except that it sounded better on FM. They figured, why not? We're not making any money from FM, so why invest anything in it beyond the cost of the transmitter and a little electricity? But in the middle 60s, there was a shift. Popular music was moving from singles to albums. And at the same time, people were starting to get into high-fidelity music. And FM was the perfect medium for broadcasting this music because it sounded so good. Rules started to come in that discouraged simulcasting AM signals on FM. So that means station owners had to figure out how to create some new programming on the cheap. They didn't want to spend too much money, but they had to invest in something. And a few started to turn their FM stations over to long-haired, dope-smoking DJs. Their style and the style of these stations was exactly the opposite of the fast-talking, super-hyped AM radio guy. Here's a sample. This is a station in Houston called KFMK. It promised progressive rock 24 hours a day. And what you're about to hear is exactly how the station sounded, complete with all the pauses and dead air.
The Jefferson Airplane. Triad. Wow. Song written by, I believe, which? Crosby, X of the Birds. I believe we asked the airplane when they were up here, which it was. I believe it's Dave Crosby. One of the Crosbys.
That was typical. That's what people listened to back in the day. Steely Dan once wrote a song about FM radio called FM No Static at All for a movie soundtrack in 1977. We could play that, but I found this cover by an Australian power pop specialist named Michael Carpenter instead. As good as FM radio sounded, it really didn't trouble AM radio much until the late 1970s. By that time, more cars were getting FM radios. More people had FM stereo receivers at home. And more music fans wanted to hear their music in the highest possible quality. AM had been the dominant form of broadcasting since 1920. But 58 years later, 1978, it was time to give up the crown. And that's when FM listening exceeded that of AM in the United States. AM radio nearly died out, and it would be extinct if not for the rise of right-wing talk radio and sports radio. However, in Canada, AM stations playing music continued to be very successful well into the 80s. That's because the rules governing FM made sure that you couldn't replicate AM programming on FM so that AM station owners would be protected from the better technology. Instead, there was this focus, these rules, that made FM broadcasting as diverse as possible, as different as possible from AM. It was actually illegal to run a top 40 format on FM in Canada. That was because of something known as the hit-non-hit rule. This specified that no more than 49% of the songs played on FM could have made it into the top 40. The other 51% had to be non-hits, songs that never made it past number 41 on the charts, or they had to be non-singles, so album tracks in other words. And there was more. You couldn't play a song more than 18 times a week on an FM station. Top 40 formats required at least three times that repetition to work. FM stations also had to run specialty programs outside their usual music. So a rock station would have to run, by law, a jazz show or a classical music program or a blues show or all three. And there were also big, big requirements for how much talk you needed to do every week. Spoken word from hosts and DJs was broken into categories like mosaic and foreground and surveillance. And woe to any radio station who did not adhere to all these rules. You could actually have your broadcasting license taken away. It was insanely difficult to keep track of all these requirements and quotas, but it forced Canadian radio to evolve differently than what happened in America, even after all these rules were dropped in the 1990s. The effect of that evolution can still be heard today. British radio sounds different still in terms of presentation because of the influence of the BBC. Private commercial radio did not come to the UK until 1973, and even after all this time, the BBC's influence is still felt in the way private broadcasters do things. Today, FM is the dominant form of radio, but even that's changing. We'll get back to that in a bit. First, though, time for some Queens of the Stone Age, and God is in the radio. Josh Homme and Queens of the Stone Age singing about what comes out of the radio. There have always been other options when it comes to listening to music in the car. In the 1950s, Chrysler and DeSoto cars could be ordered with an in-dash turntable. I'm not kidding, seriously. But they weren't very good and they soon disappeared. Eight-track players first appeared in Ford vehicles in the fall of 1965. And by the end of the 1960s, cassette players started showing up. CD players and changers debuted in 1984. But it wasn't until 1999 that a new form of broadcasting made it into the car. That's satellite radio. It began with three companies, XM, Sirius, and WorldSpace. XM and Sirius merged in 2008 to form Sirius XM to avoid going bankrupt like WorldSpace did in 2009. Without getting too technical, satellite radio uses something called the S-band, which is part of the spectrum of microwaves, 2.31 to 2.36 gigahertz, to be exact, which is just below what we use for cordless phones and some Wi-Fi. Because these signals come down from satellites orbiting the Earth at a very high altitude, satellite radio is kind of like those old border blaster stations. We can drive all over North America and still get the same series of channels. The signals cover millions upon millions of square miles. That's cool, but there are disadvantages. You have to pay a subscription fee for satellite radio. It's not terribly portable unless you use an app, but even then you need a subscription and you have to burn up data. And not all the channels are commercial-free, which is a very big deal to some people. Is satellite radio a competitor to terrestrial radio? Well, yes and no. They each have their role and use. And now we're basically living in a state of peaceful coexistence. Big Daddy only, are you listening to me on the satellite radio? Have the galaxies in where the stars burn. Steve Earle, singing about satellite radio. There were other forms of broadcasting, too. Some parts of the world have adopted something called DAB, or digital audio broadcasting. This isn't AM or FM, but a completely different set of frequencies that broadcast digital signals instead of analog ones. MP2 files, if you really want to get technical. DAB started in Europe and almost came to Canada, but because the United States refused to adopt the European standards, something about them interfering with their military frequencies, DAB never took hold, even after Canadian broadcasters spent millions experimenting with the new technologies. Meanwhile, large swaths of the world are all in when it comes to DAB. For example, 99.7% of the population of Norway is served up by DAB broadcasting. Switzerland is at 99.5%. Germany is at 98%, which is a little more than the UK. Canada and the US? 0%. This, as some of those other countries are so happy with digital audio broadcasting that they're shutting down all their AM and FM transmitters, leaving North America with a very old technology. America insisted on something called HD radio. And before you ask, there's nothing necessarily high definition about it. HD radio is just a trademark like Kleenex or aspirin. It is digital, but these signals piggyback on standard analog FM signals. If you've purchased a car since about 2012, chances are that it has an HD radio in the dashboard. The problem is that the general public really hasn't shown much of an appetite for using these frequencies. Ask a person on the street about HD radio, and they'll go, huh, what? HD radio has potential, but enthusiasm seems stillborn. Back with a few more tidbits about this thing we call radio in just a sec, including why we're about to hear a bunch of commercials. There are a couple more things I want to cover before we wrap up this two-parter on 100 years of radio. The first is the history of what we just heard, the radio commercial. Like I said earlier, terrestrial radio has always been free. You turn it on, there it is. The only way traditional radio stations make money is by selling advertising time. And the more listeners a station has, the more it can charge for advertising. That's private radio. National radio like the CBC and the BBC are funded, at least in part, by governments, which is why most state radio doesn't run ads. But let's go back. When radio took hold in the early 1920s, no one was sure how to monetize the new technology. It cost money to send these electromagnetic signals over the air, and there was no way to charge for those signals back then. So how did you pay for everything and turn a profit? Well, the answer was advertising. Back in those early days, most stations were owned by companies that made radios. That was the purpose of radio stations: help sell more radios for their parent company that made radios. As far as we can tell, the modern radio commercial was born in August 1922 when WEAF, an AM station in New York City, ran the first radio ad. WEAF wasn't owned by any big company that could subsidize costs. They were on their own when it came to finances, so they came up with the idea of selling slices of radio time to sponsors. The first commercial was for the Hawthorne Court Apartments in Jackson Heights. The station got $50 for 10 minutes of paid programming. Things were slow at first, but by October 1922, WEAF had made $550 in ad sales. The first commercial jingle, a radio commercial with singing, was aired by Wheaties. This is from 1926.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran. Won't you try Wheaties? For wheat is the best food of man. They're crispy and crunchy the whole year through. The kiddies never tire of them, and neither will you. So just buy Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land.
Other stations noticed, and by 1930, about 90% of American radio stations were running commercials, and the return on the investment was huge. Radio stations were running commercials. And the return on the investment was huge. The Selector, singing about their radio back in 1979. A few years after that song appeared, a new form of musical entertainment appeared that threatened radio: MTV and music video channels. Remember how video was supposed to have killed the radio star? No. How many 24-hour video channels are there today? And how many radio stations are there? Yeah. We're facing a new revolution with 5G technology. This new super high-speed connectivity has the potential to change things in ways that we can't even imagine. Some experts say that this is like when the internet first started being adopted in the middle 90s. No one could have predicted what's happened with the internet in such a short period of time and how much change has resulted. Meanwhile, though, traditional terrestrial radio remains popular, powerful, and profitable. So don't believe anybody who says no one listens to the radio anymore or radio is dead. And yes, we know there is much evolution and change ahead of us, but because things continue to work so well, it's kind of like changing the wings on an airplane while flying at 38,000 feet. It's kind of tricky. But we will be with you for a while yet. And remember what I said about being a cockroach or a tardigrade? We're kind of like that. I hope you enjoyed this look at 100 years of radio. It has a fascinating history and, if you ask me, a bright future. I've been a radio fan since I was 6, still part of it. I've seen lots and lots and lots and lots of changes, but every single time, radio has adapted, evolved, and not just survived, but thrived. And I don't see that changing. This program used to be just a radio show, but in an example of evolution, it is now available as a podcast for on-demand listening. You can choose from hundreds of episodes anytime you're ready at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or any other podcast platform. My website is ajournalofmusicalthings.com. It's updated every day with all manner of music and radio-related information. Get the free daily newsletter to make sure you never miss anything. Technical productions by Rob Johnston. I'm Alan Cross.
You've been listening to the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross. Subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
QR Calgary is 770 CHQR AM, a Chorus Entertainment radio station.
This is Global News. I'm Joshua Azizi. The federal conservatives say they will cooperate with the liberals to end the U.S. trade dispute.
Leader Pierre Poilievre met with the conservative caucus on Sunday as they prepare to return to the House of Commons without him in the chamber. Poilievre said he's told Prime Minister Mark Carney that the conservatives are ready to work with the liberals to bring an end to tariffs imposed by the United States. Now, despite showing some cooperation, Poilievre went on to accuse Carney of putting his elbows down when it came to opening exemptions for some counter-tariffs levied against the U.S. Cooperation on any front would mark a departure from the Conservatives' relationship with the previous Liberal government led by former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. David Augustine, The Canadian Press.
Meanwhile, the Liberal Party caucus has voted against adopting the Reform Act, which would create a formal process for MPs to eject their party leader if the need to do so arises in the future. Parliament resumes on Monday. King Charles will read the throne speech Tuesday. President Donald Trump says the U.S. will delay implementation of a 50% tariff on goods from the European Union to buy time for negotiations with the bloc. Trump says the agreement came after a call Sunday with Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission.
We had a very nice call and I agreed to move it. I believe June 9th would be, July 9th would be the date. That was the date she requested. Could we move it from June 1st to July 9th? And I agreed to do that, and that she said we will rapidly get together and see if we can work something out.
Trump had threatened to impose the tariff on EU goods in a social media post on Friday. Russia and Ukraine have swapped hundreds of prisoners of war.